We're talking about terms of service contracts here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When you go online to buy something or use apps, you've encountered these long, complex service agreements. These user agreements can govern things like how a company uses your data. Click agree, and you may forfeit your right to sue, for instance. And then this influential group of legal experts postponed a vote last week on a proposal that critics say would bind consumers to contracts they don't agree with or just plain old don't understand. Do you ever read the terms and conditions on apps and websites, or do you just click past them so you can get on with what you need to do? And if you have read them, did you understand them? We're at 800-642-1234. You can join in. Ian McDougall is a contributing reporter at ProPublica, and his piece about online consumer contracts is called "Soon You May Not Even Have to Click on a Website Contract to Be Bound by Its Terms." Ian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what are these terms of service contracts, and where do we encounter them most often?
They're really everywhere online. Essentially, what they are is sort of standardized terms that by clicking agree, for example, if you, download software or are making purchases online, you are binding yourself to this often very, very long and very sort of complex set of terms written in sort of legalese by lawyers. And at times, some courts have found, and the group you're just talking about, would probably make this more common, simply browsing a website and not leaving it can be enough to bind you to those terms.
And is each contract unique, or do they share a lot of the same stuff from one website to the next? Is there a typical contract?
They are likely unique, but they do have many. There's a lot of overlap. So, for example, you would likely see waivers of, for example, if you're buying something, waivers of class action litigation, meaning even if, it's not worth it for me to go to court because the thing I bought wasn't worth it. You know, if there are many consumers, we can kind of essentially all bind together, and so some of the cost is shared that way. Often there are mandatory arbitration clauses, which means you can't even go to court. You have to go to this sort of private, fairly opaque process that's viewed as very pro-business. You may give up the right to sue near where you live. You might have to travel to New York or to wherever the manufacturer is based. Those are fairly common terms that are in these kinds of agreements.
And these agreements also have information on what the company might do with your data?
That's right. Yeah, there's really run the gamut from just sort of collecting essentially what you're doing on the website to collecting where you're coming from to you may agree to allow them to surveil your conduct in other ways, and probably most troubling to a lot of people is there's often provisions that allow for the data that is collected by a website to be essentially bundled and sold to data brokers.
You these online contracts ask consumers to do things that you never have to agree to in real life. And you give an example of buying jeans at a Walmart store. Can you take us through this?
Sure. So, any, big box retailer, essentially, if you go to the store, I suppose at least those of us of a certain age, I don't know, maybe the younger generation is just online these days, but, you go and you bring the, whatever jeans, whatever it is to the cashier, you may sign some sort of receipt if you use your credit card, but you basically know what the terms are. You are giving a certain amount of money for a product, and then maybe some limited other set of terms, but it's there right in front of you, and it's not that voluminous. If you try to engage in that same transaction online on that retailer's website, you are dealing with a set of terms that are many, many, many times longer than what you would see on a receipt at a store. You may be giving up things like there's something called the warranty of merchantability, which basically means that the product you're being sold would pass without objection in the trade, and you often give that up when you buy something online, whereas you wouldn't in person. And then there's also the kinds of things we were just talking about, class action waivers, arbitration requirements. You may indemnify the retailer for cost if you have a dispute with them. And then, of course, there's the data and privacy issues, which, of course, wouldn't come up in an in-person transaction.
So the warranty of merchant ability, I've never heard of that before.
It's one of many sort of essentially background rules that, whether it's in a contract or not, govern the sale of goods in most and maybe all states. But those kinds of warranties, of which there are several, are the kinds of things that are often you're essentially agreeing to waive in these online agreements.
And we've all done it. We've clicked on the I agree button for these terms of service contracts. You know, reading them is a whole nother story. How did these contracts become so difficult for a person to understand so long?
Yes, I mean, they have these kinds of contracts. The general idea, they're called often contracts of adhesion, meaning the seller just gives it to you and you can take it or leave it. They have a long history, and the sort of current state of things goes back to, I guess there's a legal reason, a business reason for the reason they are, as long as they are, as complicated. The legal reason is in the 90s, there was federal judge in Chicago named Frank Easterbrook, who's viewed as a very smart but very pro-business guy, and he ruled in this case essentially that in buying software with shrink wrap that has the sort of terms inside the shrink wrap, once you open it and use the product, even if there's no evidence you actually read the terms, you've agreed to them, that then you can kind of see the leap to going online from there. And so then from a business perspective, there was good reason to want to pack as much as you can into these contracts if they're going to be enforceable. You know, the people who are in favor of this sort of thing say, well, it's just, you know, it's more efficient for them. They don't have to negotiate each of these aspects. The critics say, well, you know, when you sold these things in person, you didn't have these things at all, so it's not clear why you really need all this. But for businesses, it's kind of, you know, there's no page limit, there's no word limit. Why not put in everything you want? And then if a court says, no, this term isn't enforceable, well, so be it. But it also, you know, people are less likely to look at terms or see terms that they don't like if they're sort of buried in a very long a document full of legal jargon.
We're talking about terms of service contracts with Ian McDougall as our guide. He's a contributing reporter for ProPublica. You can join in 800-642-1234. If you've never read online terms and conditions, why don't you read them? Does it bother you that online contracts are written in legalese? Does not knowing what you're agreeing to concern you at all? Or are you unfazed? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ian, what about allowing companies to sell our data? What does that mean, and where can our data end up when you click I agree on a contract?
Well, you know, it's a sort of ever-evolving thing. I think there's, you know, with the concerns about Facebook and so on, we may are seeing and probably will see more and more restrictions, sort of pro-privacy restrictions. But, you know, there are, you know, companies that essentially buy large volumes of data from all kinds of retailers and other websites, aggregate all of that, and then sell it to, basically whoever can pay for it. So that's, you know, that means it can end up in the hands of, you know, sort of the most basic thing, I guess, is people trying to sell you something, but certainly they're, you know, potentially more troubling, purchasers out there, I suppose.
So even if a company doesn't have an arbitration agreement in their contract, what are some other restrictions that might be included to limit a consumer's ability to sue?
Yeah, so the you know, there's the class action waivers. You know, one of the big problems with this stuff is you know, even let's say a car, which is probably in the upper end of you know, cost for a consumer good, it's often not worth it to hire a lawyer to litigate that because it's probably going to cost you more than the value of the car. And the likely payout for an individual plaintiff is going to be so low that a lawyer's not going to take it on contingency, which means they'll just take it. You don't have to pay them up front, but they'll take a part of the award. So class actions were a way to kind of have a bunch of plaintiffs come together and make it more likely that a lawyer would take it on like that. It's quite common now to have that kind of thing waived in these contracts. There's also things like, you know, mentioned where you can sue. So even if you're allowed to go to court, you might have to travel halfway across the country or hire a lawyer halfway across the country if you want to sue. There are sort of protections for non-copyright material. This probably doesn't come up quite as much, but, you know, in terms of how you can use the product can be limited in ways that many consumers may not know. And there are sort of other ways that financial liability is often required to be waived in these agreements.
How have courts responded to people fighting against online terms and conditions?
It depends on who you ask. There certainly have been many cases like that, especially harkening back to that case I mentioned earlier from the shrink wrap era. The courts have said, you know, it's unrealistic that people aren't going to read these things. We have backstops, you know, if a term is unconscionable or something like that, we can deal with that on the back end. Other courts have said, well, you know, we need to be more wary of instances where really important terms, where you're waiving really important rights, for example, are buried in hundreds of pages of legalese, like those, you know, end-user agreements you get from Apple when you buy anything there, for example.
We're talking about service agreements on websites and what they mean for people who shop online or even browse the internet. Ian McDougall is a contributing reporter at ProPublica. He's been writing about these contracts. Lawyers out there, what's your take on all of this? Do you think online terms and services should be more user-friendly? Or is this the way companies need to operate in order to protect themselves? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email your thoughts on terms of service. The email is ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to this discussion in just a minute. Stay with us here in the Ideas Network. We're looking at the world of terms of service, these contracts that we encounter all over the place online. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last week, the American Law Institute was about to approve a sweeping reinterpretation of consumer contract law, and the group postponed their vote indefinitely. And so now we're talking about what it means to abide by the terms of use for a site. How do you solve that problem that barely anyone reads the terms and conditions of a contract, even after clicking to agree that you've read it? We're at 800-642-1234. Ian McDougall is a contributing reporter to ProPublica, and he stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Barb joining us from Milwaukee. Good morning, Barb.
Good morning. When my son was in college, both my sons were in college, they decided to design a website called Yes, I Disagree. And it was all about the terms and services. One of my sons was an English major. And so he was reading all the terms and services on every single website he could find. And then he outlines on his website what the different little key points are for each place. My other son, excuse me, was in IT, so he designed the site. It was, you know, a given. Anyway, these there are things on there that are really tricky. Like there are some sites where if you click yes, I disagree, they have access to all of your photos and they can use them for their own purposes. So, excuse me, before you want to give all your kids information away, you really should read this and not sign it. And I think it's important that people actually go through and figure out, are these things that they want to give away all of their contacts on, you know, on their phone or all their kids' pictures or et cetera, et cetera.
Barb, thank you so much for the call. And Ian, are there resources out there that people can go to better know what they are getting into?
Well, that website she just described, I wasn't aware of it, but that sounds like a great resource. You know, I won't pretend to be an expert in sort of the resources for checking on these things, but there certainly are websites like that out there. You know, I will say one thing that, you know, a lot of the debate has been about whether these kinds of agreements should be allowed or not, or how they should be governed when you get to court. A sort of middle ground that I think there are people in both the business community, although probably fewer of them, and in the consumer advocacy community, think is not a terrible solution is to have essentially a requirement that, and this sort of already exists, but that really important terms like the ones that the caller was just describing need to be, you know, really foregrounded and highlighted in a way that, that people will be able to see and make a conscious decision, yes, I agree, or yes, I want to keep browsing this website, or no, I don't want to give up all of that information, I don't want to give up whatever rights.
Well, and I wonder, are there any, like, secondary things that can happen once you do click agree that can say, like, hey, it, you know, do you realize that, you know, we can mine your photos, we can mine your contacts that you have in your phone right now, that there could be, you know, even some secondary screens that to make sure you really do agree to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of one of the sort of middle ground solutions that I think some people have brought up. You know, the argument from the business side is, oh, it's inefficient, it's annoying to consumers. That may be true, but the other side would say, well, yeah, but, you know, consumers are going to want to know before they're agreeing to give away all this private information or agreeing to give up certain rights. They're going to want to know that they're doing that. And they may very well still agree to go ahead and make that, use that website. But at least, you know, then they're making a conscious decision to engage in that transaction rather than being sort of blindsided by it.
Well, help us understand who the American Law Institute is and what this organization has to do with online contracts.
Yeah, it's about a century old. It's not really widely known outside of legal communities, but very, very well known to lawyers. It's essentially was founded to try to clarify and sort of concentrate in one place, almost like an almanac, something called the common law, which essentially is, you know, we have statutes that make law, but the U.S. comes from a British tradition of judge-made law, and that governs things from contracts to, you know, who's responsible when someone gets hurt in an accident to, you know, property rights. That's become more and more based on statute over time. But what the ALI did essentially was create these, what they call the restatements of law, which tried to draw from judicial opinions across the country. You know, each state has their own judicial system and can make their own common law rules, and try to kind of figure out, well, what seems to be the majority rule? You know, is there a minority rule? You know, so 20 states do this, 30 states do that, and where do things seem to be heading? And so that was kind of their core innovation, and those restatements have traditionally been used. And so there's one for contracts generally that's been around for a really long time and is highly respected. Those are viewed as something close to an authoritative statement, or historically have been, of the common law by judges. So you see those cited in judicial opinions, you know, across
yeah.
the country. And sometimes states will even adopt them as essentially their own law or parts of them.
So what was the ALI, what was this group trying to do for online terms of service? What did it want to, what was it voting on?
So it was a new restatement, which would be focused on essentially a subset of contracts, these consumer contracts we're talking about, and the bulk of it deals with, you know, the online e-commerce kind of world. The objection to it from many members was essentially, well, we already have this general contract one. Why are we making this sort of slicing off this one piece of it? Essentially the disagreement was about whether they should do this at all, or whether it's, you know, fine to have it be part of the general contracts restatement.
So if this does come to pass, what would it look like from the consumer's perspective? What would this mean going forward on websites and consent?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how quickly websites and so on would respond to it, potentially quite quickly. But, you know, really what would happen is, you know, if this became a respected restatement, you would see it get cited in judicial opinions. It would influence the law in that way. And it might also influence, you know, state legislatures when they're passing statutes that deal with this kind of stuff. So in that sense, its effect on the law might, you know, take a little bit of time. But, you know, I think if businesses see it heading in that direction, they may be all the more inclined to push along the lines that they've been moving until recently.
So, Ian McDougall, in your reporting on all of this, going deep into terms of service, is anyone out there coming up with an alternative, another way of doing these contracts so they are more understandable, but they still protect companies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of some of the stuff we were talking about earlier, the sort of highlighting in some fashion, whether it's some additional screen or providing the, you know, really important or really significant terms in some sort of bolded, obvious way. I think that's one of the sort of big ways that consumer advocates and so on would like to move this process.
And I understand that Elizabeth Warren had a role in trying to get the ALI to stop this vote. How political are terms of service and, you know, what contracts are like for consumers online?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's consumer protection has become a quite significant political flashpoint. I mean, Elizabeth Warren helped set up the CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. I'm pretty sure I got that acronym mm-hmm. right. And there's been a lot of pushback against it. There was a great New York Times Magazine piece recently by Nick Confessori about Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff for the president, really trying to dismantle a lot of the work they have agency has done. So it's a highly politicized statement. You know, any time there are business interests who are putting money into lobbying and so on, interest groups representing consumers doing the same, you know, of course, there's going to be a political fight about it.
Well, Ian, before we let you go here, just a few seconds, but how do you approach terms of service contracts when you're online? What do you do?
I mean, I'll be honest. I'm a lawyer too, so I shouldn't admit this, but I don't read most of them. I mean, it's you know, they're very long, they're hard to get through, and I kind of know what's in most of them. And the truth is, I don't know if this is how it should be, but I feel like I have kind of a fatalistic view about it. But that's because I think the way the law has allowed it to evolve.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Ian McDougall is a contributing reporter for ProPublica, and his piece about online consumer contracts is called "Soon You May Not Even Have to Click on a Website Contract to Be Bound by Its Terms." Just ahead, today is National 529 College Savings Plan Day. We'll talk about those plans. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.